Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 199, recorded Thursday, April 11th, 2024. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. One sort of expanded topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, Smile for Security, the future of facial recognition in travel. Coming to you from the Travel Commons studios in Nashville, Tennessee, a couple of days after a last-minute 200-mile trip up to Carbondale, Illinois, home of the Southern Illinois Salukis. But, well, that doesn't really matter. What did matter is that Carbondale was right in the center of the solar eclipse's path across North America, which meant we had over 4 minutes of total eclipse blackout. Looking up straight into the sun with its corona glowing, wavering around the black disk of the moon. We've all seen pictures of total eclipses, and of this one also across all of the social media and regular media Monday afternoon. But the pictures couldn't do justice to being there, even if there was the far end of the Salukis Stadium parking lot, backing up to, I don't know, some scraggly bit of woods. But being there live and physically having that experience more than made up for the 3 hour drive up there and then the 5.5 hour bumper to bumper traffic back. I added to my list of things that even though we've seen them, I don't know, maybe an infinite number of times, an infinite number of pictures of them, having that experience in real life was definitely worth the hassle of having to physically travel to see them. On my list, the Taj Mahal, the Great Wall of China, Niagara Falls, all of them, again, seen videos, seen pictures, but being there physically in front of those just was a completely different event. Being under a total eclipse of the sun, absolutely right up there. As opposed to, say, I don't know, the Mona Lisa in the Louvre, you know, the crowd of people with their phones in the air trying to get a picture of the Mona Lisa was way better than the actual Mona Lisa itself. Now, before that, in the start of March, we were in Oaxaca, Mexico for a week. Now, I've had Oaxaca on my list of, you know, to visit places for maybe 4 or 5 years now. For me, it was a good match. The combination of interesting food, lots of culture, and I got to say, no beach. I'm just not a beach person. And I've done sort of resorty Mexico, Cabo, Cancun, Puerto Vallarta, and I don't know, I'm just not a big fan. It's just, there seems to be, for me, more of a hassle factor in Mexico than the joy I get coming back out of it. But Oaxaca, completely different situation. It is now my favorite place in Mexico. While there are a lot of tourists there, it didn't seem to be overrun with them, say, like, I don't know, the center of Cabo is. Maybe because the city center is bigger in Oaxaca, so there's more space to absorb them. Or maybe just the absolute number of tourists is lower. I gotta tell you, it wasn't an easy nor a cheap flight to get there. We hit the food scene pretty hard, high and lowbrow. Food stands in the market, high-end places serving up just phenomenal moles. But the food that made the biggest impression to me was the insects. Now, there's kind of these memes going around that all the climate change people want to get people off of beef to eating insects. But, reasonable people can differ on this. But I got to tell you, the insect eating in Oaxaca, this was not some sort of tourist baiting shtick. I was walking past a group of street vendors one day, and I just saw one woman making a snack of a couple of grasshoppers wrapped in a small tortilla. Nobody was looking at her. She was just pulled it out of her bag. She was a little hungry. Now, at a mezcal bar on sort of the eastern edge of the Centro, the bartender put down a small bowl of grasshoppers as a bar snack. Actually, if you follow Travel Commons on Instagram, you can see a picture of that bowl of grasshoppers in my Oaxaca story. Anyhow, the bartender sets them down. He says, "These are good grasshoppers. I drive an hour up towards Pueblo to get them. They're not farmed like you get in the markets." Now, I got to tell you, I'm I'm not enough of an insect connoisseur to be able to pick out the finer nuances between free-range and farmed grasshoppers, but they were, I got to tell you, for me, and I'm not a big insect guy, but they were, I don't know, as good as beer nuts for a bar snack. I finished them all off. They were fine, or they seemed to be, or maybe that was just the third, or maybe the fourth. Or it could have even been the fifth shot of mezcal talking. So following up, friend of the podcast, Alan Marco, swung by the website to leave this comment about the last episode. Alan writes, I was assigned an EV by Avis at Fort Lauderdale at the end of February. Curious enough to try it out for the relatively short distances I would be traveling, I got in. After starting, I noticed it only had a 10% charge. So, yep, check please. I fired up the Avis app, selected a Chevy Malibu with about 1,200 miles on it. It was great. Now, as for Booking.com, we've had tremendous luck using their website for most of our accommodations over a two-month period in Southeast Asia about 5 years ago, exclusively for hotels, though. Hey, Alan, thanks for that. You know, I got to tell you, Avis, what, you know, expecting you to drive off with a 10% charge? I mean, Avis would never think to give you a car with just an eighth of a tank. And if for some reason they did, if it kind of slipped through their QA checks, it would take them, what, 5-10 minutes tops to fill up the tank and get it back to you? But for that EV, even at a Tesla supercharger, that's at least an hour to charge that thing up, maybe more. No wonder they tried to get you to do it. And as regards to Booking.com, my experience with their hotel product actually is the same as yours. Never had a problem. Irene loves it. But their property rentals? Nah, never again. One of my regular travel pro tips from years ago was don't take the last flight out, because if you missed your connection or your flight was canceled, you at least had a backup. There was one more flight going out. And as an IROP, I-R-R-O-P passenger, industry lingo for irregular operations, you would typically have priority on the open seats on that later flight. Actually, even more priority if you've got frequent flyer status on top of being subject to irregular operations. But nowadays, with U.S. airlines sporting load factors over 80%, this strategy seems to be a lot tougher to get to work. Now, last June, back at episode 194, I talked about how United's delay leaving Amsterdam meant we missed our connection home to Nashville through O'Hare, and how I spent about an hour between the service agents at O'Hare and on the phone to some call center saying, this is unacceptable, 2, 3, 4 times before they finally found 2 seats on that later flight to Nashville that for the previous hour they had been saying was completely full. Now, this trip flying home from Oaxaca through DFW on American, I had gotten an email the day before saying that there could be bad weather and, oh, geez, you know, you can make a change to your plans for free. That would have been a little tough finding another place to stay for one more day in Oaxaca. So we were going home that day. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, well, if for some reason our flight gets delayed, there's always that later flight. En route from Oaxaca to DFW, I was connected to the plane Wi-Fi, and about an hour before we land, I get a notice from American. Our flight to Nashville had been canceled. Jeez. All right, that sucks, but no panic. They'd rebook me on the later flight. But I keep reading. No rebooking. It just tells me to go to the American app. Now, mind you, I'm still in the plane, and the Wi-Fi over northern Mexico, I have to tell you, is just not the greatest. But when I do get the app to respond, it's not showing this later flight as an option. Indeed, the options keep changing with each refresh, each time I refresh the app. And it's not showing anything later that day. There's nothing earlier than the next day, Friday, or sometimes not even until Saturday, which is 2 days later. It wasn't until after we landed, passed through immigrations, were waiting at baggage claim to pick up our luggage so we could go through customs, that we finally got a message through the app that said they'd found us seats on the later flight. Still got home that night, but in both those instances, the United instance last year, this one with American this year, the customer service experience has just degraded so far. I mean, I had to push very hard and honestly be a bit of a jerk to get what used to come seamlessly. And that's not what I want to be doing. But neither do I want to be staying overnight checked up in a DFW terminal. So you got to do what you got to do. Now, there's another travel tip that seems to need retiring. Use Twitter as a concierge service, or X, or whatever you want to call it. I'm honestly, as long as it's still Twitter.com, I'm going to still keep calling it Twitter, no matter what Elon Musk wants. Anyhow, while struggling to rebook, while still in the air from Oaxaca, I pinged American on Twitter, hoping for a little more help. What I got back was an amazing, and I got to say, a little depressing, thanks, Elon, amount of spam messaging masquerading as American Airlines customer service agents. Now, it's easy to get fooled in the panic and in the rush of trying to find a way home in an irregular operation event. But I have to tell you, there's a few rules you got to keep in mind. Number one, only communicate with the airline's gold-checked verified accounts, in this case, at American Air. Ignore messages from everybody else, like American Air Help Desk, all in caps, Jason Frank, it was uppercase Jason, lowercase Frank, American Air Manger, yes, manger as opposed to manager. And absolutely never give out your phone number unless you absolutely want to get swamped with scam calls. So I don't know. I think I'm going to have to go back and rework some of my travel tips for the next iteration of that blog post. And hey, just a quick programming note. At the end of the episode, going to be giving a little status of the podcast. So for those interested, hold off on hitting the skip button when you hear the music. And as always, if you have any travel stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along to comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter. I did. I said Twitter, not X. Twitter. Message to M. Peacock. Post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account. Or you can skip all that social media stuff and do like what Alan did. Post your comments straight on the website at travelcommons.com. The only topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, Smile for Security, the future of facial recognition in travel. You know, over the years on the podcast, we've talked about how travelers are seeing more and more use of biometrics in their travel days. I've told the story of my first fingerprint scan back in the late 90s. I did it so that I could skip the U.S. immigration line on my weekly commute home from Toronto Pearson Airport to Chicago. And just to show you the difference, my colleague's reaction to that same offer, I'm not giving the U.S. government my biometrics. Compare that to my reaction. Wait, I can skip a 3-minute line? Where do I sign up? I think it shows that the privacy versus convenience choices just haven't fundamentally changed all that much over the past 25 years. But, surprise, technology has, and at least to me, it seems to be accelerating the use of biometrics, especially facial recognition. Boarding our flight to Oaxaca, our face was our boarding pass. Just looked at the camera, wait for the bing, and then move on. And then coming back, the global entry kiosks no longer need passports. You no longer have to twist your hand just so to get all 5 fingerprints to register. You just walk up, it takes your picture, and tells you to move on. Which got me wondering, where is this going in the next, 3 to 5 years? To help answer this, I invited 2 guys who have been digging deep into this for a number of years. First up, Dr. Sheldon Jacobson, professor in computer science at the University of Illinois. Sheldon, if you recall, was last on the podcast, episode 189, in September 2022, telling me why another one of my travel tips, catch the earliest flight you can, is not always right. Now, over the years, Sheldon has developed operations research models that optimize aviation security. So I asked him to come back on the podcast to talk about this growth in biometrics. So Sheldon, thanks for coming back on to the Travel Commons podcast. Wanted to talk with you about biometrics, facial recognition, all the things that seem to be increasing with regards to air travel.
Well, the airlines, as well as the Transportation Security Administration, need to know who you are when you are traveling. And they've relied on identification cards, driver's license, real IDs are continuing to be part of the future. But ultimately, the best way to determine who you are is through your face. And biometrics and artificial intelligence imbued with it, in fact, is the solution that people are recognizing. The airlines are starting to use it. And of course, the Transportation Security Administration is investing billions of dollars to advance this idea. And there's a reason why they're doing this. They're doing this simply because the traditional model of airport security screening has been to detect stuff. Prohibited items, knives, explosives, firearms, even, you know, full-size tubes of toothpaste could be a threat based on explosives that could be embedded in them. However, the real threat are the people. And facial recognition is a means to transform the platform for airport security from the detection of items to knowing your traveler. And that's where we're heading right now. And this is the future of airport security.
And how does that work? How do you think that works?
TSA has not broadcast this. And I don't even know if they're thinking about it, but I have thought about it. And I have proposed to them, because I visited them in October 2023, and I told them that if they can bring facial recognition, biometrics, and the use of AI to truly validate and authenticate the travelers, the need for physical screening will be reduced tremendously to the point that they can create a new class of traveler, which I would call a super pre-check traveler, who subjects themselves to greater background vetting, but then they would be treated like a known crew member at an airport and require no further physical screening. That is the future of airport security.
It's almost like Back to the Future, right? It's almost like back to pre-9/11 days.
Now, some will argue, oh, someone will game the system and we will have a terrorist threat because of that. And I would argue the exact opposite, that the only people who would be willing to subject themselves to the background check would be people who know that they're going to get through it fine. And the ones who are truly threats cannot risk, because rarely are people acting by themselves. They're often acting in a network. And as a result of that, for them to be exposed, they would be exposing their whole network. And the risk of doing that is far too great. What it would also do is it would parse the whole spectrum of travelers into a group of people who are willing to be known and a group of travelers that are not willing to be known. But over time, the ones who are willing to be known will be much larger, which means you can target your resources and your attention on this so-called unknown group and actually make it more secure for the air system by targeting your resources in that way. After September 11th, everybody was treated the same, the one size fits all. TSA PreCheck moved away from that. Now I'm proposing we move even further. And our original research, which we presented to the TSA in 2003 when we propose this idea of differential screening to them and how it would work and why it would be beneficial. We said that you really need three classes. Two would be fine, but three would be better. And it turns out that third class is what we would now call a super pre-check class of passengers. And those are the people who would be treated like crew members, the known crew members. And a lot of people would be willing to pay for that privilege. And we've put boundaries on what that means. It wouldn't be renewed every 5 years. It would be renewed potentially every year. It'd be more expensive. But there's a lot of business travelers who are willing to pay that price to basically pass through security untethered, but they aren't a risk to the system anyway, so why waste resources and time on them? It would transform the footprint and create what I would call security tunnels rather than security checkpoints for many of these people.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. What was the reaction to that at TSA?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can say that.
No, understood. Got it. Understood. I just had to ask. Well, that's a great concept, and I appreciate that insight around your guys' research. You're right. I mean, there's something that says you just look at what people are willing to sign up with Clear, with Global Entry, with PreCheck. Again, frequent travelers will always look to streamline that experience. And so I would agree. I would say there would be people in a heartbeat who would raise their hand for that.
Exactly. Right now, people who sign up for Clear pay $189 on the top end for 1 year, being able to be identified as who they are and go to the front of the pre-check line. That's all they're paying for. And they're not paying for anything more. If the TSA implements a new class of passengers, then Clear would become superfluous and literally would go away.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking also.
It's just, it will not be needed anymore. And in some sense, the pathway of using what the TSA calls the credential authentication technology too, which basically validates who you are using biometrics, as well as that you're entitled to fly that day. You don't even need a boarding pass right now when they implement this. And in some airports, they have it. Clear will have to find a new business model because the TSA is going to usurp that model into their own operations.
You can kind of feel that. And indeed, I still think this most recent version of Clear, and I had originally signed up for the initial version way back 10, 15 years ago, whenever it first started, Rev 1.0, and then they went bankrupt, and now we've got Rev 2.0. But even today, I still have a challenge to see a compelling business model for the service that they offer. Oftentimes, a lot of the airports I'll go into, the difference between a Clear line and just a basic pre-check line is pretty much nothing.
Exactly. I've never been impressed with their business model. They've tried to sell it for stadiums and large entertainment venues. The challenge is it's just been difficult, and most of their money, most of their resources, most of their revenue still comes through airports, and they need that. I just don't see the future of it being very bright.
Is there more facial recognition coming or different facial recognition coming? Where do you see that path going?
Well, we are nowhere near the end game on this.
Okay.
Facial recognition, as effective as it is, I mean, the concept is ideal and wonderful. It's still not perfect. It misses certain people of color. It struggles at certain times. And research is continuing to bring the error rates down lower and lower and lower, especially if you're going to create security tunnels where people just walk through it and your picture is being taken literally in real time, matched up using facial recognition. And then next thing you know, you're at your boarding gate because everything worked out fine for you. And that will be the majority, the vast majority of travelers. So we are nowhere near the end of this. We are at the beginning. I think the challenge right now is the perception that people do think there is a privacy concern. And I, like I said, I think it's exactly the opposite. I think this is opening up opportunities where we are going to spike in one dimension of AI, which is facial recognition, and then the rest of the screening aspect at airports and validation literally gets dampened and in some cases completely eliminated. I'm a firm believer and supporter of facial recognition for airport security and air travel. I know that if they do it right and they seem to be on that pathway, that we are going to have a very different experience at airport screening for security and even air travel in the next 5 to 10 years. It's just going to be radically and dramatically different. And I think when people realize that and begin to experience that, they're going to be happy for it. But at this point, a lot of the rhetoric is around privacy, but our privacy is being violated so often, so frequently, and in so many venues that that argument is no longer holding any water. I am convinced that this is a positive future for air travel in all aspects.
Sheldon, thanks very much again for joining us on the Travel Commons podcast and sharing that. That's great stuff. Now, our second guest is Henry Hardeveld, a travel industry analyst for many years. He's got the depth of experience and the industry context to give us kind of a ground level view, a ground level sense on what's coming with regards to biometrics. So, Henry, thanks for joining us today on the Travel Commons podcast. Wanted to talk about biometrics in and around air travel. And specifically, I don't know if this is recency bias or what, but it just seems like I've seen a whole lot more of, especially facial recognition over the past couple of years. What's your cut at it from a travel industry standpoint?
In the crawl, walk, run continuum, I would say that with biometrics, we are somewhere between crawl and walk. Think of biometrics as the baby who is crawling really fast, and you know it's going to start walking any day now, but in the meantime, it's scooting all over the place. So let's break it down. Using facial recognition cameras for boarding flights has actually been around since before COVID began. I think the trials started somewhere in the 2016-17 area timeframe for international flights. It's the only time it's used right now. And it started to roll out in 2018, 2019. Delta was one of the first to embrace the technology, and JetBlue as well. And what it does when it works well, and this is something we should come back to discuss, but when biometrics facial recognition works as everybody wants it to, it speeds up the boarding process. It reduces the need for us to show not just a physical boarding pass, but a physical passport. And as a result, on a wide body jet, it can shave perhaps 10 or more minutes off the boarding time on a single aisle plane, 737, A320 type of plane. That could shave 5 to 7 minutes off. So it speeds up the boarding process and makes everything a little bit more efficient. It's not perfect. There are people who are uncomfortable using it. There are people who are not familiar with it. So airlines have to have a belt and suspender type of approach. They'll have to have gate staff there for the time being. But I don't think we are that far away from where international travel is primarily biometrics-based boarding, at least in major airports. And I think we will start soon to see it being tested for domestic travel. But there's going to be a wrinkle with that. When we use the biometric readers at the gate to get on a plane, the database links back to U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, which has photographs of U.S. citizens, resident aliens, and international visitors. And it can call up on that data to validate that you are you and I am me. With domestic flights, I think only TSA has the biometric data right now for pre-check. So it may take a little bit of work to get to a point for that. So that's boarding. But let's talk about airport security. Yes, TSA is indeed testing. And in some cases, I think it's actually beyond testing. They are rolling it out. Mm-hmm. Facial recognition that, again, eliminates the need for us to take out a driver's license or passport or any other physical ID. And importantly, eliminates the need for us to show any type of boarding pass, whether it's a paper boarding pass or digital boarding pass. And again, in theory, it speeds up the number of people who can get into and through the security screening process and reduces the need for human agents at those checkpoints. Now, right now, again, we're still very much at the beginning of this. And TSA is saying we are going to have a security screening officer at that checkpoint in case something goes wrong or in case someone isn't comfortable using biometrics.
Yeah, that was my experience in Nashville. There was a guy standing right there.
Right. And as we record this, the TSA is testing at Las Vegas, basically this walkthrough type of environment, a new type of screening, which is biometrics based to validate who you are. You put your bags on the belt, you go through, it's a lot less invasive, a lot less intrusive, and supposed to be a lot faster. I actually want to go over to Las Vegas just to check it out and see what it's like. They have this in Dubai. and they're testing it elsewhere. In England and in France, they are testing it on Eurostar.
Interesting.
Now, there are a lot of other things coming along with biometrics at a lot of European airports and in Asia as well. I was just in Singapore. Mm-hmm. There are biometrics-based scanners so that you don't have to queue up and have a border patrol officer review your passport, stamp your passport.
I had that at Heathrow last November.
Right.
I went through the e-gates. I was just surprised. I walked at the other, went through the other end. I was like, wait, this is it? Like nobody to stamp my passport, no nothing? Just like, no, right. Get out of here.
Now,
go, move on.
Now, for those of us of a certain age, yeah. Part of the love of travel is hearing that clunky thunk of the passport officer stamping your passport. Yep. And, you know, every time you get a new passport, the passport service mails back your old one. Those become mementos of our lives.
Absolutely.
And there is a part of me that will miss the day when we get our passport stamped, just as there is a part of me that misses airline branded paper boarding passes to, you know, show, oh, here's where I have been and so on.
That obviously then pivots over to, you know, how should the travelers think about biometric data and the storage of that and the risk of that as, you know, as a condition of travel?
Look, it is obviously a personal decision. Our research shows that right now in the U.S., far more travelers would trust sharing their personal biometric information with an airline than with any government agency. So in the U.S. right now, it's nearly 80% of travelers, of airline passengers, excuse me, who, and this is first quarter 2024 data, fresh off the press, if you will. Nearly 80% of U.S. airline passengers, business and leisure, say they're willing to share their personal biometric data, fingerprints, iris scans, et cetera, with an airline they fly regularly, if it will lead to a more efficient airport experience or journey. Only a quarter of passengers say they're comfortable sharing their personal information right now with any government agency or entity, even though, again, with the same benefits of an easier journey. Now, both of those numbers are up from 2023. The government obviously takes keeping personal data safe. They only keep certain information for a certain amount of time, usually 30 days or less, and then it is expunged. So I am in the crowd that is comfortable sharing biometric information with governments and airlines because doing so makes my journey more efficient. It's faster. It's less stressful. It's fewer people that I, you know, need to interact with. Yeah. Certainly at times where I don't really feel like interacting with someone. Remember, we're somewhere between crawl and walk. But where I see it from the analyst perspective, the time difference, the time it will take us to go from crawl to walk will probably be many times longer than the time that will be needed to go from walk to run. Because again, as improvements emerge with the technology, the hardware, as well as the software, changes in society, changes in social acceptance of biometrics, appreciation for benefits, we will reach that so-called tipping point where all of a sudden we see massive and welcome acceleration. It's interesting. Younger travelers are a lot more suspicious of government than some of their older counterparts, and travelers over 65 are less willing to share personal data with government.
That's interesting. That's an interesting distribution.
Like 30 to 64-ish, call it. And I think that there's an important point for anyone listening here. If you work for an airline, for a technology company, for an airport, for a government agency, or for that matter, if you work at a hotel company, cruise line, or other parts of the travel industry, you cannot view your customers as a homogenous block. And you have to understand their welcoming and use of technology. The irony is, as we all know, Gen Z, are digital natives. They're very comfortable using technology. They will put anything and everything on social media, it seems like. But they have some very legitimate concerns in their minds about how will governments use their biometric data and could it be used against them? And I'll just add that hotels are looking at how do they evolve the check-in process. Right. You know, I think one of the dumbest questions in the world is when we are standing at the front desk of a hotel, suitcase in hand, giving them our credit card and ID, and the agent says, checking in? Like, no, I thought I would just, I had nothing better to do. So I thought I would bring a suitcase to a hotel in a different city and hand over a credit card and my personal information just to say hello.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And by the way, I like standing in line. So that's why I've been waiting for 10 minutes to get up and, exactly. and have this conversation with you.
Exactly. But, you know, hotels are looking at how do they improve the check-in process? And granted, at the five-star true luxury properties and resorts, I think they will say, look, we value and our guests value the human interaction, but they're going to be a part of that guest who can say, look, there's some things I can do for myself. And then I want to talk to somebody about some other stuff. But I think at, you know, four-star and below, be prepared for more biometric-based self-service check-in, check-out experiences. And I think, frankly, a lot of people would welcome it because it's a lot more secure. For 99.9% of us, eventually, I think biometrics will be more than welcome. And again, if it makes our journeys that much more efficient and less stressful, less unpleasant, there is, to me, no downside.
Yeah, I think the cases you've laid it, I think is the appropriate one, which is it's a combination of frictionless or an efficient travel, much more efficient than what we have today, mm-hmm. doing away with as many lines as we can. And on the same token, being more efficient for the travel company, be it a hotel, be it an airline, be it the company running the airport, so that their costs stay down and our costs stay down to travel. So the trade-off on that, people are going to strike their own balance right. around privacy versus efficiency. Right. Henry, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for coming on the Travel Commons podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it as well.
So thanks so much to Dr. Sheldon Jacobson and Henry Hardeveld for taking the time to talk to us about biometrics, facial recognition, and give us an idea of what we travelers should expect to see soon. Check out the show notes at travelcommons.com for links to their work. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 199. I hope you enjoyed the show and the conversations with Sheldon and Henry. They had so much great insight. I got to tell you, the editing decisions for this episode to keep it under, say, 2 hours was tough. Probably one of the toughest I've had. Now, this is usually the point in the wrap-up here where I say, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. But this is, as my friends in the UK would say, the penultimate episode of the Travel Commons podcast, which to a Midwest guy like me is just a fancy way of saying second to last. The next episode will be number 200. So a good round number to end it all, wrap it all up with. I'll unpack all of this, the reasons, my other thoughts next month in that episode, but just wanted to give you guys all a heads up. As always, you can find us and listen to the current episodes on all the main podcast sites, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Amazon Music. Google has shut down their podcast app, at least in the US, but you can now get these episodes, these regular Travel Commons audio episodes, on the Travel Commons YouTube channel. I don't know, go figure. I can never keep track of what bits Google is shutting down or renaming or, I don't know, repainting pink or blue. But you can always ask Alexa, Siri, or Google, I mean Google for now, to play Travel Commons on your smart speakers if you've got one of those running around. You can click on the link in this episode's description in your podcast app to get to the show notes page at travelcommons.com for a transcript of the episode and links to Sheldon's and Henry's websites. And Along the side of the page at travelcommons.com, you'll find a link to all the Travel Commons socials, including the Instagram site, if you want to take a look at the picture of the grasshoppers. If you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text your audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons page on Facebook or Instagram, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. And thanks to everyone who takes the time to send in emails, tweets, posting comments on the website. I really do appreciate it. And until next month, when I wrap up 19 years of travel podcasting, safe travels. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.